Actually running a little bit ahead of schedule here. This is scheduled to start at 10:10. I did want to ask both council if you are waiting for anybody else to attend.
I am not. I mean, it's hard to tell because I think all the observers are just identified as observers. So I'm going to assume the people who want to be here are here right now.
Okay, I just want to make sure that you're not waiting for any parties or any particular observers. Otherwise, we can go ahead and get started.
Yes, I am ready.
Okay, thank you. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, March 20th, 2024. This is the second of our cases set for our oral calendar and oral argument. This is A23-1642. And I'm sure I am going to mess up the name, but it's Fideli Ndarahutsi versus State of Minnesota. And counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your oral arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant. We are holding these oral arguments via Zoom.gov. These are being recorded and live streamed. No other recording, however, is permitted, but both parties and anybody else, if they wish, they can get access a recording of these within the next day or two. We also have, because it is via Zoom, rather than having the timer on the podium, we do have a screen that has the timer, so just be mindful of your arguments and how much time you have. With that, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Chang Lau. I am an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant, Fidel Ndarahutse. In my brief, I raised two arguments. Today, I'd like to focus the court's attention primarily on the first, and there are a few points I'd like to make regarding the second, if time permits. Our first argument asks this court to reverse the district court's post-conviction order denying Mr. Ndarahutse plea withdrawal because, first, Mr. Ndarahutse proved that his attorneys affirmatively misadvised him of the immigration consequences of his guilty plea to an EJJ adjudication for robbery by telling him that there was no risk of deportation if his EJJ probation was never revoked. And second, looking at the evidence contemporaneous with Mr. Ndarahutse's plea, and when comparing what little benefit he received from pleading guilty in this case and what he risked losing if he were deported, there was a reasonable probability that but for counsel's affirmative misadvice, he would have proceeded to trial.
Counsel,
I think,
can we just
oh,
focus on the affirmative misadvice for a moment?
of course.
It's my understanding that we're dealing with some unsettled law, or it's just not clear of the deportation consequences in the EJJ context here. Is that right?
Well, I think there are two ways to look at it. Devinson Charles, the federal BIA decision that I cite, is a binding decision on immigration judges and Department of Justice. And so in that case, the language is fairly clear that a juvenile adjudication that can ripen into an adult conviction and result in an adult sentence is a conviction for federal immigration purposes. Now, as Nestor, Mr. Nestor, our immigration attorney at the evidentiary hearing, testified to, there's not a published decision that rules that Minnesota EJJ adjudication is a federal conviction for immigration purposes.
So
But there
given
is an
that,
unpublished opinion that does say exactly that.
we're dealing with I guess persuasive authority and not binding authority, help me understand why the advice that counsel gave fell below an objective standard of reasonableness when there's at least some murkiness here as to what the binding authority is.
So the first thing I will say is that the law is not clear for Padilla purposes such that counsel needs to advise more than that there's a possibility of deportation. I mean, we'll concede that. But the fact of the matter is that regardless of whether you see the law as settled with the BIA decision, Devens and Charles, or as unsettled because there isn't a case law directly on point with regards to Minnesota EJJ, the advice was affirmatively wrong from counsel to say that you are safe from deportation so long as probation is not revoked. Because as Mr. Nestor testified, that's simply misleading because it is not true, right? Even if the case law is not settled, there is at a minimum a risk, if not a great risk, that Mr. Nadar Hutse was subject to deportation, even if his EJJ adjudication for an aggravated felony was not his that probation was not revoked. So regardless of how you look at the federal law on whether or not EJJ adjudication without revocation of probation is settled, that advice was affirmatively wrong. And
But
so,
so then,
oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I believe you muted.
here we go. I'm sorry. I appreciate that,
No,
counsel. Thank
no,
you.
no, no.
Thank you for the explanation. So if we go to the second step of the Strickland analysis, which I think is kind of where the rubber hits the road in this case, the district court did make, or the post-conviction court did make, a credibility determination and found that your client's testimony about whether he would have entered the plea was, but for the affirmative misadvice, was not credible. So, given our deference to credibility determinations by the district court, what do we do with that?
So my position on that is that this court does not need to defer to that ruling, that district court ruling, as a factual finding, such that it only overrules it if it's clearly erroneous. Our position is that that ruling is a legal determination. So the court looked at, or is a legal determination for this court to make. The ultimate question with regards to that second prong is if Mr. Nadar Hutse had been properly advised, would he have proceeded to trial? Now, the fact that he testified that he would have is not really relevant. This court still has to look at the totality of the circumstances to determine whether or not that prong is met. And so
That's a little troubling. It's a little troubling for me, to be honest, counsel, just because it seems like it is a factual determination. Your client did testify at the post-conviction hearing, at the evidentiary hearing, that he would not have entered the plea but for the affirmative misadvice. And the district court says, I don't believe you. Essentially, that's what the court. And so why is that a legal determination as opposed to a garden variety credibility determination by the post-conviction court?
well, again, because that ultimately is what this court is trying to decide when it's conducting that analysis of the second prong. And so I think a good way to look at this is to refer to the Lee versus United States case, where in that case, the court says, the appellate court should not upset a plea solely because of post hoc assertions from a defendant about how he would have pleaded, right? And we're not asking this court to do that, but the court continues and says judges should instead look to contemporaneous evidence to substantiate a defendant's expressed preference. So again, our argument is not simply because Mr. Nadar Hutse testified that he would have proceeded the trial, he's met the second prong. Our argument is that he has testified to that, and the contemporaneous evidence that was presented to the court during the post-conviction evidentiary hearing substantiates that he would have gone to trial.
What are you looking at specifically? Because in terms of the evidence, it seems like this is a pretty simple case. I mean, the victim shows up and testifies, case closed. And what factors are you focusing on?
Also, correct me if I'm wrong, Your Honor, but I believe what you're sort of alluding to is the fact that Had Mr. Nadar Hootsey gone to trial, he almost certainly would have been found guilty. Again, Lee versus United States, and the post-conviction court found that to be the relevant and persuasive factor as well. But if you look at the case in Lee versus United States, the United States Supreme Court basically says that under Strickland, that is an irrelevant factor, that you look instead at what the client or what the defendant was advised, and regardless of what he faced at trial, would he have taken the even the small likelihood of winning at trial in order to prevent himself from being deported? That is the relevant consideration, not what have gone to trial, because what ultimately Lee is stating, what is being protected, is the right to go to trial and the not the the right to be found not guilty.
Right. So what are you said there was evidence at the hearing that the court did not factor in. So what was that? What are you focusing on?
The court didn't consider the fact that Mr. Nadar Hootsey was 16 years old at the time, that he'd only lived with his parents up until that point in his life, that he, if he risked deportation, he risked being separated from his parents, the rest of his family, to a country, either a country where he'd left when he was 3 years old, where he did not speak the language, where he did not have families or contacts, or to Rwanda, where he faced likely persecution or death because of his father's political affiliations. The district court did not take any of that into consideration.
I mean, that's like the first paragraph of the facts section, counsel, of the district court's order.
But the court
You
didn't
didn't.
consider that in its analysis. It considered only either evidence that was not contemporaneous with the plea, which Lee suggests should be the relevant considerations. And it considered the fact that the prosecutor gave made a statement about the possibility of deportation during the plea hearing. And I forget the fourth factor. I believe the court considered that the court determined that there were two charges that were dismissed as a result of a plea agreement, and there's actually no evidence to substantiate that. And going back to what J Chief Judge Siegel alluded to about the fact that there was significant evidence to show that the state had a strong case, and that was the reason why Mr. Nadar Hootsey pleaded guilty. Quite frankly, there's just no evidence of that, right? The only thing in the record that we can consider as the facts of the case are the plea agreement, or the factual basis of the plea and the complaint. And the complaint is simply, as I argued in my brief, that's not evidence. So when you take all of those factors that the district court considered out, and you look at what little benefit Mr. Nadar Hootsey gained from entering this plea agreement, I mean, he received nothing, right? The worst he could have gotten was EJJ probation until he turned 21, and being sent to Red Wing. And that's exactly what he got, and 48 over months over his head.
So, counsel, the other thing that the district court did take into account was that he had been told by the prosecutor when he pleaded guilty that he would very likely, could be deported on the offense. And so, why doesn't that go to the district court's credibility determination, for which we give great deference?
Well, the court didn't find that Mr. Nadar Hootsey's assertion that he believed his defense attorney, who consulted immigration specialists, who Mr. Nadar Hootsey knew consulted an immigration specialist, believed his attorney over the prosecutor. Now, I mean, to support the fact that an advisory about that may or may not contradict direct misadvice is not sufficient to is not dispositive of that second prong, I'd ask this court to look at its unpublished decision, which we cite in our brief, in Niagoka. In that case, the plea petition did tell the defendant in that case that there was a possibility of inadmissibility. And all the same, this court ruled that it was reasonable for the defendant in that case to believe his attorney, who had consulted an immigration attorney, over that advisory because he testified to it simply. And it made sense. And the other thing I will say is that, it's fairly undisputed what Mr. Nedarhodzé was advised about immigration before he pleaded guilty. He was told basically that he was safe if his revocation was not revoked. Now, for the prosecutor to simply say that he could likely be deported is not necessarily inconsistent with that advice. I mean, she doesn't expand on her statement about the possibility of deportation. She simply says that it's a possibility. Mr. Nedarhodzé could have interpreted that to mean simply that if he violated probation, he would be deported or could be deported, which is consistent with the misadvice. Now, the last thing I want to just quickly note for this court is to correct an error in my brief while I have the 30 seconds remaining. I identify a case that the district court relied on regarding the restitution issue as Robertson. It's actually Anderson. It's not a huge error that the citation is correct, but I do just want to note that that was an error on my part. So if I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, but I just ask this court to allow Mr. Nedarhodzé plea withdrawal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, and thank you for that clarification. We appreciate it. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Charlie Droppo, and I'm the Assistant County Attorney at Clay County here. Your Honors, I think that this case just really comes down to if there was affirmative misadvice, and it's the state's position that the relevant law and case law, it's just not clear whether or not there was misadvice that was given to Mr. Nadaruste. I noted in my brief that there was kind of two different mechanisms to kind of look through this. I think that State v. Sanchez kind of outlined whether it was a strict view of Padilla, which would just be the defense attorney looking at the relevant statutes. And then the more expansive view that was proposed under in Sanchez about reading for Padilla, which would be reviewing the relevant administrative decisions and immigration law decisions. And I think under that view as well, it's just not clear. So I think that's kind of the state's main argument regarding whether or not Mr. Nadaruste was given affirmative misadvice by the attorney Snyder.
Well, when the law is not clear and the consequence could potentially be deportation and the defendant is not advised of that consequence, why is that not below an objective standard of reasonableness for an attorney not to at least advise the client of the potential on a aggravated robbery that they might be deported if their EJJ is revoked?
And Your Honor, I think that the advisory goes with for Padilla. I think is essentially they need to just give do the research to essentially figure out whether it's supportable or not, and then give their attorney the advice. I think they just need to get
but
the general
Padilla
advice.
Is, I mean, there's no question about Padilla here. This is a question about affirmative misadvice. That's a completely different situation.
And Your Honor, I think that the advice that is need to be given, if the law is not clear, is technically just under Sanchez. I think it just says that it's a general advisory of you could face the immigration consequences and deportation, which I think was actually given on the record at the Rule 15 as well. He doesn't have to necessarily give the advice. I think if you have the law is clear, he needs to give the specific advice that you will be deported if you do plead guilty to this.
So, I mean, I'm wondering if that cure is sufficient when the defendant has been told something that is incorrect or potentially incorrect.
And Your Honor, I think that's kind of one of the issues we have to kind of address. But the information given to him, I mean, it's the state's view that it was not incorrect, because it's still the state's view that and I addressed this briefly in the brief, but there still is no on-point case law that says if he had not been revoked, he would have been sent to he would have been subject to deportation. Mr. Nadarusse never was subject to deportation until he was revoked. The case cited out of the immigration law in the unpublished case was another case, and the one out of Minnesota where it talks about EJJ for the immigration law. That one was another case where the person was revoked and then sent to prison, and then when released, he was deported by ICE. So I'm not necessarily sure that the law is specific enough to state that if you just plead guilty to EJJ, that you will be subject to deportation.
But counsel, we did have the testimony at the post-conviction hearing from an immigration law specialist, Mr. Nestor, who basically said that the advice that had been given in this case was the wrong advice and was counter to what should have been provided. Why shouldn't we conclude that the post-conviction court abuses discretion by ignoring that testimony?
And Your Honor, I think that I think Mr. Nestor also testified that there's no directly on point case law. I think he said something to the effect of it's strongly suggested by certain cases. I think he noted a case out of New York and out of a different district that the EJJ could be treated as something deportable. But I think he did state on the record there was no on point case law saying that an EJJ by itself is deportable.
Let me ask you some questions about the district court's credibility determination, which goes to the second Strickland prong. So, on page 9 of the district court's order, the district court or the post-conviction court finds that the testimony offered by the appellant was not credible in so far as he would not have pled guilty but for the affirmative misadvice. But then the district court, or it looks like that conclusion is based on a series of findings by the district court. There was significant evidence of his guilt. He had other files that were resolved, and he was advised on the record that he'd be very likely to be deported. In your view, does that credibility determination hinge on the factual findings that follow, or is it independent of those factual findings?
Your Honor, I think it's independent of those findings, and I think that
Okay,
the
and explain why, please.
yes, and Your Honor, I can explain. I was at the post-conviction hearing. I think at one point, he was Mr. Nadarusse was asked point blank by the state, you were advised of this, and you were advised that you could likely be deported on by the state at the hearing. Why didn't you believe us? And I think he just said, I thought you were lying, he said that to the prosecutor. I think that the district court judge in this at the post conviction relief was the if I recall right, the procedural posture, she was not the dispositional judge at the time. She was familiar with Nadarusse at during all of his probation hearings. I think that's when Judge Merkins would have taken over that role. I think that there, I don't think it was ever explicitly stated on a record that, but I think there was, I think she did put in her order that he did have a number of cases of resolved at the same time of the disposition. Whether or not that was part of the necessarily stated on the record as part of the plea agreement, I think, looking at the record, it looked like there was a bunch of cases that wrapped up at the resolution of this case.
So I'm looking at the credibility conclusion itself. Are the other than the three reasons that are set forth in the post-conviction court's order, is the credibility determination based on anything else in your view? And
It,
if so, what would that be?
and Your Honor, I guess I'm not, I'm not the judge that wrote the order, but I think that, the judge was able to watch him testify at the hearing, his answers, including telling the court that he thought the prosecutor was lying to him previously, And also the defendant has no reason not to, you know, he has every reason to say whatever he wants to try to get this thing reversed, to not, you know, I think it's just what the judge decided. I guess I can't speak for why the judge determined that.
But counsel, part of the plea colloquy also included the discussion of you have received advice from your counsel. You had a chance, opportunity to talk to your counsel. It was very clear that his counsel also had talked to an immigration law attorney, which is their standard operating practice. And so for him to rely on his attorney rather than one statement by after extensive discussions, both on the record and off the record, versus one statement by the prosecutor, why does that support the post-conviction court's credibility determination? It seems like the record doesn't support that. And credibility determinations we have to give deference to, but there has to be some support for them as well.
In Your Honor, the credibility of it, you know, and I alluded to this in my brief, but you know, when we do the Rule 15, we have to take some deference to the plea that they're pleading on the record, that they are getting firmly advised of their rights, that they're waiving those rights. If we're not going to, you know, accept that a Rule 15 is always a Rule 15, we could open the floodgates for every defendant to say that they were firmly misadvised afterwards when they come up and testify. So,
well, I don't see this necessarily as opening the floodgates, because I think what we have to do is we have to follow the law. And the law says that if you misadvise a client, that can support a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. I don't see that necessarily as opening the floodgates, because both prongs of the Strickland test have to be met.
And certainly, Your Honor, and it's still the state's position that he was effectively not misadvised, or there's not enough affirmative law on it to say that he was misadvised. And I understand that the appellant has argued over and over again that it, through the brief and the filings, that the Mr. Schneider's advice that he got through the immigration attorney was affirmative misadvice. And I know previously that, you know, we asked why should we defer to Mr. Nestor, who testified at the hearing. I could say the same thing about why we're not deferring to the immigration law attorney who sent at the Minnesota Immigration Law Center, who sent the email to Mr. Snyder. I still think that there hasn't been an actual finding of the EJJ by itself being enough to deport somebody. I don't know that there's any case that I could find that's ever come up where someone actually just pled guilty to EJJ and then was subsequently deported, even being successful on probation. And I know that there's some issues with looking at these different decisions. I think the one that kind of addresses out of Minnesota is from 18 years ago. And even that in my brief, I cite that I don't know necessarily that just says it's not technically a juvenile. That doesn't necessarily, it's deportable by that.
But doesn't the fact that it's an unanswered question, doesn't that, and it's not 100% clear one way or the other, doesn't that lead to at least letting them know and advising them, you know, you could be deported then? The fact that it's an open question, it's unclear, doesn't that require the advice be you could be deported? Because that possibility exists, right?
And Your Honor, I think that the advisory that's needed to give is a general advisory of immigration consequences. And Mr. Snyder, the advice that was given to Mr. Nadarusse, it was, you will not be deported unless you violate EJJ. And then on the record, he was asked affirmatively by the prosecutor, if you could, you know, you will more likely to be deported on. I don't know that by... It depends on what the correct ruling by an immigration, if the immigration courts ever came out and specifically spelled out that you will be deported by EJJ or you will not be deported by, or you will not be deported until after the revocation. And I don't think that the case law necessarily asks for a large finding other than you may be deported by this, but. And I'm not... Seeing any other questions? If not, I'm fine to give my time back to Mr. Lau.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Just a few points. I mean, I don't know that any of your honors here are in disagreement about what our claim is, but at the end of the day, what Mr. Drapeau is saying that all counsel needed to advise was not the advice that was given, right? So I don't think we'd have a claim here if the advice from the trial counsel was you risk deportation if you plead guilty and your probation is never revoked. I think that would actually be an accurate representation. But at the end of the day, at the very least, Stebbins and Charles casts into doubt whether or not that advice is true, because Devens and Charles says in a juvenile adjudication that can ripen into an adult conviction and sentence constitutes an adult conviction for federal immigration purposes. And if it's an aggravated felony, you're mandatorily deported. That's very straightforward. And so the advice based on that authority that you necessarily will not be deported if you don't violate probation is wrong. That's just simply misadvice. There's no two ways about it. The other thing, and Ellis Strong is very clear when read together with the unpublished decision, Iacocco, is very clear that when you even if you have no obligation to advise, say for example of a collateral consequence, but you do and you get the advice wrong, then your performance is deficient. That is exactly what happened here. The second thing I will note is Judge Frisch's concern about, well, is this a is Mr. Nidar Hootse's statement about whether he would have proceeded to trial or not, is that subject to clearly erroneous and abuse of discretion review? I mean, in my mind, if a defendant testifies that he would not have proceeded, and that transforms that analysis from an abuse of discretion to clearly erroneous, that I mean, that doesn't make logical sense to me. So we would be in a better position had Mr. Nidar Hootse not testified to that. And then that statement would not be subject to a credibility finding by the district court, and the district court would be given less deference,
But then, how
which
does the district court handle the second prong of Strickland? There's just no, I mean, in the absence of that testimony, it has no evidence that, but for the misadvice, that the outcome would be different.
well, respectfully, I disagree. I think there's plenty of evidence outside of that statement that Mr. Nidar Hootse would not have pleaded guilty had he been told that you risk the possibility of being sent out of the country where all of your family lives, including your mother and father, at the age of 16, where you'll be left to fend for yourself. I mean, that is strong evidence, in my view, that, had he knew he faced that risk if he did not violate probation, he would not have taken that deal.
But
And
counsel,
so,
that still depends on his testimony at the evidentiary hearing, doesn't it?
I mean, I don't think there's any authority that says he necessarily has to give that testimony in order to satisfy that second prong. I don't think that case law exists. And so, it shouldn't be the case that if he testifies to it, then we're looking at a clearly erroneous standard and we provide all that deference to the district court. And if he doesn't testify to it, then he's in a better place. Now, what I will also say is that I think both Judge Frisch and Judge Reyes noted that at the end of the day, even if we are under a clearly erroneous standard when we're viewing the court's determination on that factor, it's the district court doesn't get carte blanche deference to make any finding without support. And ultimately, I think the factors that the district court considered were not legitimate ones, because either they were not supported by the evidence in the record, or they were not contemporaneous with the plea, which is what Lee asks the court to look at. And So, even if we are under that standard, we should still win on that prong. So, in sum, I just ask this court to overrule the post-conviction order and allow Mr. Nadar Hootsay plea withdrawal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for the arguments on this very interesting case. We appreciate the briefing and the oral arguments, and we will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.